Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. This season is made possible in part by a grant from the Knight Foundation and the Community Foundation of Grand Forks and East Grand Forks. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today, we're talking with our guest, Ryan Ballett, about the meaning and nature of courage. I'd also like to dedicate this episode to the memory of James Nixon, Institute for Philosophy of Life board member, dedicated Why fan and donor, lover of learning, brilliant iconoclast, and dear friend. Jay, you will be missed. Many years ago, when I was in graduate school, I took a class in which we discussed Plato's account of the desire to learn. The Greek word for desire is eros, so philosophy for Plato is literally erotic, and so is the relationship between teacher and student. In response, someone in the class presented a paper asking whether he himself had ever felt any erotic attraction to his own teachers. He said that he didn't, and concluded that Plato was wrong. Philosophy and eros had nothing to do with each other. Now, there are plenty of problems with this approach, but in the discussion that followed, I argued that his paper was misplaced simply because no one ever really looked at the ancient philosophers for real-life advice. The Greeks were historically interesting, I said, but largely irrelevant to our lives today. Others disagreed, including the professor, and it is one of the great ironies of my own life that I've spent my entire career proving myself wrong. The whole purpose of this show is to illustrate that philosophy is essential to our day-to-day lives. But it is also true that today's world would be incomprehensible to Plato. Changes in culture, technology, religion, and human knowledge have made the Greek life obsolete in almost every way. It's not unreasonable to be skeptical about their relevance. If I were to argue for Plato's continued relevance, I'd say two things. First, I would suggest that Plato's questions are more important than his answers because we are still arguing about the same things that he did. We don't agree on what justice, virtue, or goodness are. I'd also say that Plato tried to describe the universal human experience, not just his own culture, and that while values and technologies have changed, human beings haven't. Both of these observations will be familiar to anyone who's taken a philosophy course in college. It's how we all defend Plato. But I won't make those arguments. Instead, I'd like to suggest that we learn not just by focusing on what we have in common with others, but by examining what we don't. Change is instructive. Understanding the evolution of ideas is important, in part because today's beliefs may turn out to be as wrong as many of the Greeks were. If I could go back in time to that seminar, I'd point out that Greek education was quite different than what we have today. Now, without getting into too much detail, in Plato's time, men taught boys with the hope that they would become sexual partners. Advanced education was intertwined with courtship. Eros was institutionalized as a way of creating continuity between generations. But our colleges and universities are designed specifically to avoid teacher-student romantic entanglements, so much so that we've even stopped talking about the desire to learn. We use the phrase "the love of learning" instead. For students of Greek, we've replaced eros with philia and agape. We've rejected the idea that education is sexual and accepted the fact that learning is a joint project among equals, that knowledge itself should inspire, and that we should stand agape before the truth, if there is one. The student was never attracted to his professors in part because his universities didn't want him to be. Now, make these observations not because I want to talk about Plato per se, but because today's topic demands that we attend to the effect culture has on their words and on their meanings. We're going to examine the word courage, and we're going to do so with a guest who focuses much of his attention on the classical Greeks. Our idea of courage comes from the Greeks, just like Eros does, but has also changed, and today's show is going to examine how. Now, it's possible that our guest will suggest that we ought to reject what courage means to us and return to the original Greek idea. The show is unscripted, and anything can happen. But I doubt he'll do that. Instead, what I anticipate is that we will be introduced to someone who loves the fact that words, values, and concepts grow as cultures do, and someone who recognizes that there is pleasure in recounting this journey. Pleasure. Hedone in Greek. And because Greeks' words were also often the names of their gods, Hedone is also the name of the goddess of pleasure, the daughter of, you guessed it, Eros. a god we know by his Roman name, Cupid. So even though the context is different, we're back to Plato's claim that philosophy is erotic. And while few people would consider education hedonistic in the way that sex, drugs, and rock and roll are supposed to be, it's also true that scholars take great pleasure in learning. We lament how little time we get to do research. We want more opportunities to feel good in just that way. All of this is to say that words do not exist in isolation. Concepts are cultural, and they carry their histories with them. Courage and eros are not simply ideas, they're traditions. And if we want to really know what they mean, when we reference them, we need much more information than a simple dictionary would provide. We need context, we need to know how they relate to other words, we need philosophy, and we need to compare. And now our guest. Ryan Ballard is professor of political science at the University of Toronto. He's the author of many books and articles, including Courage in the Democratic Polis, Ideology and Critique in Classical Athens, and A Companion to Greek and Roman Political Thought. Ryan, thanks for joining us on Why.
Thank you, Jack.
We're live this evening, so we'd love to have your questions and comments. You can email us at askwhy@undd.edu, tweet us at Why Radio Show, or join the conversation with my intern, Darren, in our chat room at whyphilosophyandpubliclife.org. We're also live streaming video on our Facebook page, so if you prefer to see us in action, watch and comment on facebook.com/whyradioshow. So, Ryan, I want to ask you about the word courage itself. I can't remember the last time I used it. People now use the term brave, but courage seems so old-fashioned. Are courage and bravery different, or am I making a mountain out of a molehill?
Well, that's a good question, because I think that the language in which we discuss these ideas is tremendously important for our understanding of the concepts. I would say that bravery is something of a more limited idea than courage. Bravery draws our attention to the physical dimensions of courage. Perhaps bravery consists in or is a good way to characterize a single act as opposed to a reliable trait of character. I would say that courage, on the other hand, is an excellence of character that we ask to do quite a lot of work, that it's the thing that enables us to overcome fear or uncertainty for the sake of something that's truly admirable, a noble cause, but it can occupy many different domains. For example, the physical, the ethical, the political, the existential, and even the philosophical. So I would mark a difference, but I wouldn't make too much of that difference simply with reference to the language, because what we're really interested in is the ideas that that language is used to discuss.
You know, all of that information that you just gave makes courage seem like such a hard topic to discuss, and also something that it's hard to have. I don't know if it's harder to have an intuitive sense or if it's just harder to articulate that. It's interesting. We got a couple questions in advance of the show, as we often do. And both of the people who sent questions in advance included quotes. One, a reference to the Marines, which we'll talk about later, and one, a quote from a book. And that's never happened before. It's never happened that everyone who asked a question in advance felt the need to refer to a larger text. Is this indicative of how complicated our relationship is with courage, that we attach it to the romantic, that we attach it to the literary, that we have all this stuff wrapped around the idea?
Well, I think what it's indicative of is the fact that we care about courage so much, that it's essential to view ourselves as courageous, or at least not as cowardly. Cowardice is one of the worst insults that people can experience. And I think that people may feel, indeed, a certain degree of trepidation in trying to articulate what courage is, and yet it is such a familiar experience and so essential to living a good human life well.
Is defining cowardice easier than defining courage, or is cowardice just the absence of courage?
That's a great question. I think myself that defining cowardice is easier than defining courage. In fact, I wouldn't speak of defining courage so much as trying to articulate the questions and ideas that make it up. In the case of cowardice, I think that a behavior that is motivated by fear is a good, at least, starting point for cowardice. In a situation where a person should not feel fear, where it's irrational or somehow shameful to feel fear, to give in to those fears, to have one's perceptions or judgment colored by fear, I think that would be a good way to characterize cowardice. Courage, on the other hand, isn't necessarily motivated by a single emotion or idea or element of practical reasoning. I would say that it's highly contextually dependent. And as I say, we ask it to cover a lot of ground, a great range of topics.
The Greeks had a term that they used for these ideas that were characterological, that were so large and cultural. They used the idea of a virtue, a human excellence. We don't really have virtues in the same sense in our culture. Can you talk a little bit about what the concept of a virtue gives a culture and how we can understand virtues separate from sort of our traditionally, you know, there was a time in the 19th century when literature talked about a woman's virtue, right? From the Latin virtu, right? Meaning a woman's virginity. But we don't mean that anymore either, right? So what does the concept of a virtue do? Because courage was one of the central virtues, right?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that we have something of a problem of translation or just of idiomatic usage. When we use the term virtue, it does sound stodgy and Victorian, very old-fashioned. It sounds like chastity. It sounds like a constraint on our behavior. And I'm not sure that we have a good way to talk about it now that doesn't sound that way. As you say, it is an excellence of character. That's not a very easy, that's a mouthful. That's a very difficult thing to imagine idiomatically. So what I would prefer is to think of the ethical and to name the virtues like courage or justice or generosity or self-control and many others. Because I think those ideas, say justice, say prudence or wisdom, these sorts of things certainly do have currency in our culture. And in fact, when we think about them and look at uses of them, we see that they have very great power indeed. So that's how I would work with the problem of terminology that you mentioned. A virtue, as you know, in academic philosophy, there is a field of virtue ethics, and the virtues are enjoying a kind of renaissance, but I don't think it's very easy to talk popularly about them in that way. So I think we have to explain and then to name them and identify them.
So are virtues something that is sort of a general concept that we can get from these notions of moderation and beauty and courage, that we get it sort of, we go in the other way, that we only generalize it from particulars? Or is there a way to sort of get in the 21st century a notion of what virtue can be in popular culture in a general understanding?
Well, I think there is a way to get to a general understanding, but what we have to do is to rely on opinions about these things. So if you take an example, I started working on courage right around the time of 9/11, and there was a heated public discussion about the courage or cowardice of the terrorists, and also about the American leadership at that time. And I think if we make judgments or evaluations about particular situations like that, then I think our attitudes toward these enduring ideas become clear all over again. So, for example, Susan Sontag, the writer, had made statements about the courage of the terrorists, which she said was a courage being a morally neutral idea. She abhorred what they did, of course, but said that it was unmistakable that they exhibited courage. And that provoked a great deal of reaction and, as I say, a complex and interesting public debate. So I think that I'm not sure that we will ever have agreement on what courage is or how to apply the idea in specific circumstances in a country, let's say, as large as the United States of America. But if we draw attention to the notion and think about what's involved in it, then I think we can have a better informed debate about these particular questions.
You know, it's interesting, this idea that courage could be morally neutral, because for the Greeks, virtues were inherently moral qualities, but they thought of it more in terms of the good life and about character, not the right and wrong thing to do. And that leads us to Lisa's question. She's one of the folks who included a quote, and she wanted to know about the connection between virtue and moral responsibility. And she gives this quote from a book by David Mitchell called Cloud Atlas. And she says, he wrote, "Our lives are not our own. We are bound to others past and present and by each crime and every kindness. We birth our future." I think implicit in that is this notion that courage is inherently a social idea, that it brings with us our context, our history, our responsibilities. And so sort of in Lisa's question, is courage attached to moral responsibility in the way that we think about it today? A good deed is a courageous deed, a bad deed is a cowardly deed, or is it detached from that more act-oriented ethics and only coherent in terms of character development?
Well, I think that we can certainly talk about courageous acts, and that when we demand that someone take responsibility for something, we make that demand, we insist on that often because we're asking a person to do something difficult in a situation of uncertainty or even potential disgrace or embarrassment. And so I think that courage and responsibility are certainly linked in that sense. Now, I would say, though, that it makes better sense to think about courage in general as an attribute of a person's character, ideally as an enduring or stable disposition or trait of character, rather than as a one-off characterization of an action.
So let me interrupt for just a second, Ron. I apologize. So are you suggesting that a person can't be courageous one day and cowardly the next, but they're either courageous or they're cowardly?
No, I wouldn't say that. But I would say that on a particular day, somebody can do something that took courage, certainly. But if you were going to admire that person as a courageous individual, and to get back to Lisa's question, look at that person in the larger context of historical, political, etc., responsibility, then I think you would have to look at that person's behavior over time, because you wouldn't want to approve of somebody as a person, as a somebody's character in general, simply based on a single action. But yes, I mean, people, the fact of the matter is, we are theorizing and talking at a very abstract level, but the fact of the matter is that from day to day, as we all know, if something bad happens to us on the road, then we might act less generously in the next 5 minutes than we would have if it hadn't. So we go up and down a fair amount.
This concept of moral approval, can you say courage, can you use courage disapprovingly? Can you say out of the side of your mouth with a kind of snide attitude, oh yeah, that person's courageous, and mean it, right? Not ironically, not, you know, suggesting that they're really a coward and you're faking it, but you mean that they're courageous, but yet you disapprove of their courage.
I think it's very difficult to do that, actually. Certainly you can use it ironically and sarcastically that way, but one of the outstanding or salient features of courage is that it's something we cling to. It's something we admire and approve of. And that's why I think, again, to mention Susan Sontag and the terrorist attacks, there was such an inspired debate, because we really care that we or our people or whatever are courageous. And as I say, conversely, to call someone a coward is perhaps the greatest of insults. So I don't think so, actually.
And that's, of course, why people were so upset, because she claimed it was morally neutral, but no one believed that. They assumed that she was complimenting them because she was using this term that can only be a compliment.
I think you're right. So the problem with courage, in a sense, is that it's a virtue and excellence that we need to keep watch over, because there is no other virtue. If you think about, say, justice, if you think about trustworthiness or self-control or generosity, we don't have to worry about those virtues. But courage is in an unusual position, because it so readily speaks loudly on its own behalf and overrides the claims of justice. So people who are interested in being courageous can possibly go too far by finding situations in which to display their courage when there was no need to do so. So actually, courage is perhaps alone among all the excellences of character, that one which, as we all know, can serve evil or unjust ends. And I think that was the problem that Sontag was struggling with. She didn't have a way to talk about that. And I think that probably what she should have said simply is that maybe they were brave. What they did, in one sense, took courage, but we don't want to in any way approve of their behavior, because what we approve of is courage that is used for the sake of justice or a noble cause.
Is this use of courage in the wrong circumstance, is that what Aristotle meant by foolhardiness, which he thought was an excess? Or is foolhardiness not courage at all, just, I can't think of the word, but just craziness and ultra-risky behavior?
It's a vice, in other words, right. Yes. It's a kind of behavior that is, let's say, born of, you know, ignorance. It's harmful to the person who does it, and perhaps to others. And yes, I think that what those terrorists did was certainly reckless in that sense. Yes. So there's a certain amount of ambiguity, and if you think about other kinds of cases, some cases of recklessness are very easy to identify because they harm the individual who's reckless, a teenager who recklessly jumps to his death while trying to complete a daring dive from a cliff or something like that. But there are these difficult cases in which people do show a kind of determination to achieve their ends and overcome danger and fear and do achieve their ends, and yet we don't admire them. It's a classic problem called the courage of the villain.
When we come back from the break, I'll ask you about the courage of the villain. I know Kant talks about it explicitly. I'll also ask you directly what courage is and shift the conversation to the democratic context, because I know that that's what a significant amount of your work is on. You're listening to Ryan Ballett and Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking about courage on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Ryan Ballett and asking the question, what is courage? You know, with this show in mind, I've been thinking a lot about the uses of the word courage, as I talked about in the beginning of the show, and the uses of the word brave. And I made a mental note to look at how frequently words like this were used on the internet, particularly on Facebook, which we all probably spend too much time on. And one of the things I noticed is that almost entirely every example that I found of someone using the word brave was referencing a woman who was heavier than average, who was somehow expressing her sexuality or showing her skin on Facebook. That the word brave in the last 6 months to a year seems to be reserved for a very particular act. Now, I can understand why people would consider this brave. Someone like that, given our current standards of beauty, is opening herself up to ridicule, to insults. There's a lot of discussion now about obesity in this country and about overweight and about fitness and about all of that sort of stuff. But without taking a position on that, I found it incredibly interesting that brave became a category for a very specific act. No one would ever call me brave because I'm talking to an audience right now live of however 30,000 people is what we estimate listen to an episode. That I give interviews, that I stand in front of a classroom, even though public speaking is continually listed as one of the top fears that many people have. No one would call me brave because I decided to raise a child or because I committed to a marriage or even because I rode in a Vespa today, right? No one would call that brave. Yet there is this specific task that's assigned this term, and yet it seems detached to this notion of courage. So Ryan, I guess with all of this in mind, I want to start by going back to the classical Greek view for a second. Were there very specific acts that everyone in the Greek world knew was courageous and referenced them as courageous, and that it was the set of courageous acts and people just acted on them and other things were not part of that universe of discussion?
Well, I think the prototype of courage was military valor, and that I believe remains true today, facing down fear and the enemy on the battlefield. This was true since the time of Homer, the epic poet, through Aristotle in his famous discussion of courage, and it was a widespread idea that men, and only men were soldiers, that men went onto the battlefield, and that was the core of the concept that they had to face the enemy and fight bravely to save their cities. Now, go ahead.
And that brings to the David the other question that we got in advance. Wasn't really a question; it was a comment. And he wrote that courage is not the ignoring of fear; it's the appropriation of fear as a secondary idea. And he quoted the Marines, that there's a Marine saying that says pain is fear leaving the body. And yet at the same time, right, what I just mentioned, this notion of women standing up to express their beauty in front of perhaps a disapproving audience, does that mean that courage courage was an inherently martial virtue? Does it have to be that now? And is it inherently a manly virtue? Is courage gendered?
Well, I think that for the ancient Greeks, in the minds of many ancient Greeks, it was both manly, gendered, and martial, and that any extension beyond those spheres and beyond men was seen as illegitimate. But even in the ancient world, and certainly today, I think that courage is not a gendered term, that certainly women and men alike can exhibit courage. And even again in the ancient world, democratic Athenians and philosophers certainly began to develop other notions of courage related more to the political, the ethical, even the philosophical. So I think it's a much more expansive notion than that a rather crabbed and limited notion that was the core of the traditional Greek concept.
Is courage an ideological concept? Does it demand a worldview? Does it demand a whole system of morality and propriety and even social participation?
I think that courage as an intrinsically admirable excellence of character that is devoted to good, worthy, just, etc., ends or goals. In that sense, I think it does find itself located most naturally within a framework. In other words, that when people use the terminology of courage, they are implying much more about their worldview in a particular judgment than they may think they are, yes, on the one hand. On the other hand, I think that we've seen a number of ideological uses of courage, and one of the dangerous or toxic possibilities associated with courage is that courage and cowardice as rhetorical terms can be used to, for example, stir up militarism, for example, in the idea that you are a coward if you don't support a particular war, or you are a coward if you won't join the military, or things like that. I certainly think it can be used that way ideologically also.
So post-September 11th, when Congress changed French fries to freedom fries, part of what they were doing was calling France cowardly.
Well, I think they were. I think they were not only calling France cowardly, but also suggesting that they didn't value the freedom that courage is ideally meant to serve, and were meaning to disapprove of them and cast jibes at them, calling them, right, cowards, but also in the sense that they were not as interested in freedom. What is the opposite of freedom? They were a bit slavish. They were a bit too weak to defend what's most important to them.
As one of the characters in The Simpsons called them, cheese-eating surrender monkeys, right? that they're this group of people who don't have these other values. And you actually talk quite a bit in your book about how courage is inherently intertwined, especially democratic courage, with freedom and equality. And I want to get to that in just a second. But the voice in my head, the one that I'm allowed to listen to anyway, is nagging me and wants to ask you, what is courage? We've been talking about it for a while. Is that just too simplistic a question to ask what courage is?
No, I think it's the all-important question here. And I think that I would begin by thinking of it in a traditional way, maybe captured by Hemingway when he called courage grace under pressure, that we have to start with a notion of some sort of confidence or savoir-faire or something in situations of danger. But that when we reflect on the notion and we consider what it means to us and how admirable or how admiring we are of courage, what we have to add to that initial stab at what it means is the idea that it's dedicated to justice or to freedom, as you say, or to civil rights, let's say, to these causes that we find worthy of self-sacrifice. And that, again, as I said before, I think it has to be the truly admirable thing that it is, it has to be an enduring quality of a person, even if particular acts can display courage.
You know, Hemingway's quote, grace under pressure, also depends on how we take that quote. Grace can be a simplistic idea. Simple is the wrong word. Grace can be an idea of sort of a way of carrying oneself. But grace is also a divine concept, a Christian concept, a religious concept that implies for many of Christian denominations a gift from God, something that is put on somebody, that is granted to somebody out of the kindness, out of the love that God has. Is courage, does courage have divine elements? Is courage either in the Greek tradition or in our tradition in the 18th century, not that those are the only three options, is courage connected to the gods or God in that way? Or is courage inherently a human trait that is human, motivated by human mortal agents?
Well, the way that I think of it certainly is not within a religious framework. Thinking of it as a gift makes it sound, as a gift of God, let's say, makes it sound as though it might be a natural attribute, such as the color of our hair. I have brown hair, brown eyes. Some people are born with a kind of funny disposition, and others might seem courageous. But in my conception, it's not simply a tendency that you're born with, but rather a developed idea that you yourself have to cultivate through reflection and learning, through exposing yourself and taking risks and things like that. So I think that with that, one thing that considering it a gift of God would leave out would be the idea that a person actually has to develop himself in order to exhibit these virtues on the one hand. Now, I do want to say this, though, that I think religious conceptions, at least in the European tradition that I'm most familiar with, tend to draw attention to the notion of love. And you started the show by talking about eros, or a certain kind of love. I think that courage tends to be, just as a description, about what we love. It shows us what we love, what we care most desperately about. And I think that in that sense, it certainly can fit within a religious framework. Certainly, that's how St. Augustine represented it, for example.
Is that why Joan of Arc is, in my mind, one of the first, and my history may be off, but one of the first women who is really depicted as courageous because she's acting in the name of a god for something that she loved?
Well, I think that that she got a lot of attention because everybody agreed that the causes that she was fighting for were good. But I think that if they picked out her courage in particular, that what they were picking out was her wise, well-informed determination to carry out her will, sort of to impose her will on the reality that she confronted in the service of this cause that everyone admired.
Lisa asks why courage sometimes fails. Is that a philosophical question, or is that a psychological question having to do with one person's individual circumstances? Have there been lengthy discourses and theories about why courage fails people? Like there are, for example, many philosophers, most famously Descartes, spend a lot of time talking about why people make mistakes, why people get knowledge wrong. Is there the same sort of discussion about courage failing, or is it just this person in this instant didn't have the character, didn't have the will, didn't have the other unified virtues, and therefore they just couldn't do it?
Well, I think there certainly are discussions of failure or failure of nerve, let's say, and many literary representations of failures of courage. On the one hand, I think that as democratic centuries became more familiar in the modern world over the last couple of centuries, people who were not used to democracy, elitists and so on, tended to think that democracies degraded the possibility of courage. That is, that ordinary people were not up to the task, and explained it that way. On the other hand, I think that one thing you see is that in stories told by soldiers who return from warfare, like Tim O'Brien, a famous American poet and writer,
and who wrote The Things They Carried, among other things.
Exactly. Yeah. What you find is that when you get closer to the manifold circumstances in which failures of nerve occur, you find a great deal of complexity. So, for example, there are stories about soldiers who shook so much they could hardly stay on the front lines in World War II or Vietnam, but their fellow soldiers came to admire them for the almost heroic efforts that they made to overcome this seemingly natural endowment of fear. So I think you have a certain amount of complexity once people really start looking at cowardice in that way.
So let's shift the discussion to this notion of democratic courage. We've talked about martial courage. We've talked about courage as a character trait. What happens to courage once we start talking about it in terms of politics, in terms of making an argument and standing up before the Senate, in terms of voting either for what's right or for your convictions, depending on which tradition of democracy you adhere to? What is democratic courage different in type than the other kind of courage, or is it just an application of a general idea?
Well, I think it is an application of the general idea that I was talking about, but democracies, in my conception, provide particular resources to socialize the virtue of courage, to make it less the preserve of individual heroes and more available to ordinary people. And the way that they do that is in part through open and free discussion and deliberation, in which people think through their conceptions of courage and the ends that courage will serve, such as freedom or justice or liberation of others. And then within combination with their fellow citizens, carry those ends into practice. And I think that on the one hand, therefore, democracy equalizes courage by making it available to all citizens, and it recognizes the courage of all citizens. For example, in our own famous Vietnam War Memorial and in the ancient Athenian funeral oration and monuments like that that recognize all people and not individuals. But the key here, again, is the notion that courage, with the advent of the ancient Athenian democracy, became a more intellectual notion. People began to think and talk about it and think through its demands. And they used their more intellectual outlook on courage to distinguish themselves, say, from non-democrats such as the Spartans or Persians, whom they viewed as motivated by inauthentic types of courage.
So we have a question from Eric who asks whether or not courage requires a particular instigating event, something threatening, something dangerous. Can you be courageous in a democratic context without there being a need to be courageous? Is just voting courageous, or do you have to stand up against the masses? You were talking about Thucydides and Pericles' oration. Do you have to be part of a major event, or is just reading the newspaper when you don't feel like it an act of courage?
Well, I think I would want to reserve the terminology of courage for something I admire more than simply reading the newspaper when you don't feel like it, on the one hand. But I don't think it requires a particular event. Like, you might think that the most prominent examples of courage in U.S. history have come about at these transformative moments, such as the Civil Rights era. On the one hand, you might think that. But on the other hand, I think that given the world we live in, with all of its threats and dangers, as well as with the tendency of democracies to produce a kind of conformity, I think that we always have these possibilities available to us to sort of liberate ourselves from the conformism of ordinary life, and to, you know, confront all the dangers and uncertainties that we just do confront every day as human beings.
Is courage a prerequisite for a healthy democracy? Does a democracy have to be a collection of courageous citizens, or does a democracy just need either some courageous folks or courageous people when courage is required? I mean, to what extent, right, there's this whole discussion now and has been for the last few decades of the democratic virtues and the virtues in a liberal democracy. But courage isn't necessarily in that discussion. So should courage be a prerequisite for democracy? Is it a necessary but not sufficient condition, I guess is the phrase I'm looking for, to be a citizen in a democracy?
Well, I think it is. You're quite right to say that there's been a lot of discussion recently about the liberal virtues and that courage does not tend to figure into those conversations. I think that that's because of philosophers' anxiety over the toxic expressions of courage that I was discussing a while ago, that courage can take over and turn itself into violence and militarism and imperialism. And that's what people have been concerned about. But if you look back to the origins of democracies, for example, in the United States of America or in ancient Athens, you'll discover that the people who were founding these societies, all the citizens, in fact, were thinking of their activities, their act of founding, as a display of courage that shook off old traditional norms and provided a new world in which they would wanted to and would have to think for themselves. And I think that in that sense, if you look back to the American founders, for example, shaking off the idea that the world is simply necessary or fated or the product of force and constraint, that is, taking control for ourselves of our own political destinies, I think that actually is a great act of courage. And to be true to democracy, in which citizens are equal and in which they take on the burdens as well as the greatness of self-determination, I think that those kinds of activities do require courage.
We only have a couple minutes left, but I want to ask you about this notion of freedom that you mention in the book, in particular because it relates to life and culture in North Dakota and some stuff that's going on in the background. You make the point that the Greeks are not only interested in free discussion, but they're interested in frank discussion. And particularly in the upper Midwest, there is a pressure not to rock the boat, not to complain, not to say things that are going to offend. I feel like in our culture, being frank, being direct in person, as opposed to on the internet where everyone is, but in person, this notion of frankness has not gotten the attention that it deserves. How does frank discussion relate to what you were just talking about in this accepting responsibility for the new? Is frankness an essential component of free speech, and is it courageous, or is it just blunt and rude and sometimes appropriate and sometimes not?
Well, I mean, I think that the contextual judgment is probably necessary, but in general, I would say that we could use more frank, that is, blunt speech that may feel a little bit rude only because there are so many constraints and there's a kind of attitude toward new ideas, I think, particularly toward rocking the boat, toward saying something or thinking something uncomfortable. There's an attitude that really discourages that. And I believe that democracies were designed almost specifically to encourage people to say what they actually think is true. And that's a very great thing to do. But does it require courage? I think that we all know that it does. It takes a great deal of energy and self-assertiveness of a wonderful sort, to think for yourself and then to be able to say it in a respectful way to others.
I'm really interested in what you just said about finding the appropriate way to ask these frank questions. Because just as in the classical Greek world, the notion of virtue was a dominant moral category, in the 18th century and during the American founders, particularly on the English side, particularly the Scottish philosophers, were very concerned with propriety. They were very concerned with acting the right way in the right circumstance according to manners, where manners were a moral category. Is there a conception of courage that fits that 18th century model where courage is a kind of justified social approval? Adam Smith says people don't just desire to be praised, they deserve to be praiseworthy. Is there an 18th century conception of courage that is particular to that kind of discussion as opposed to the classical Greek virtue model that, of course, they saw themselves as the inheritors of?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I would say that in the ancient Greek world, even though there were aristocratic formalities, of course, in a certain sector of society, that what you found, especially in the democracies of ancient Greece, was a kind of informality, a kind of readiness to be different, readiness to pursue one's own pleasures and interests, and so on, that deeply disturbed those who propounded a more aristocratic vision of the virtues. And so, I mean, I think just the very notion that a person should desire to be praiseworthy, I think that's, you know, readily extendable to a variety of social contexts and so on. But I think that in more democratic centuries, as we've moved on, for example, that the formalities have dropped away for the most part, and that to a large extent that's good, because we have begun to take on our own forms of expression, say in music and the arts, and the variety of human creativity, for example, that you find has been amazing, has been explosive. And I think it's one of the wonderful products of this kind of political experimentation.
There's been a movement in the last few decades, particularly amongst critical thinking theorists, to extend the discussion from just critical thinking to both caring thinking and creative thinking. Certainly courage has to be critical, self-critical, for obvious reasons. You want to be courageous in the right way, in the right circumstances. I think we can understand how courage is caring, and there's sort of two interpretations of what caring means in this. What caring means, you do it with care, but also caring means social. But you just brought up creativity, and that brings up an interesting question about courage in particular and virtues in general. Is courage a creative act? Do virtues have creative elements? Does it come from the same part of the human experience that music, that art, that narrative storytelling, that writing, that comes from? Or because it's characterological, for the Greeks at least, are there no creative aspects? I want to rephrase the question just a little bit because I'm sort of figuring out as I'm asking it, but we often talk of creative acts as themselves being courageous, that this artist was courageous in doing this thing and pushing the boundaries and exposing themselves in a certain way. Does it work the other way around? Is courage a creative act in any sense?
Well, I think that it is. I mean, I think that insofar as courage is a performative virtue, that in other words, in each situation in which a person finds himself, say you mentioned parenting a while ago, I think that we are all making things up as we go along, and that different situations demand different kinds of appreciation and understanding and intelligence. And as a result, I think that we, in a sense, when we embody courage, we are simply making it up as we go along. And in that sense, it's very creative, because a person who has a sort of sterile character trait that is not adaptive, let's say, to different scenarios, will not be able to perform or to behave excellently in these scenarios, will not be praiseworthy, as you say, or worthy of admiration. But I also want to say something else about this, that when I'm talking about creativity just now and referring to parenting, I think that there is something extraordinary often about the ordinary. And I think that's a very democratic concept. So I am happy myself to attribute courage to those who do the hard work, let's say, of parenting or of maintaining a job, maintaining friendships, that sort of thing. These are very difficult things, and ordinary people do them all the time, and it takes courage. So that, in other words, courage, particularly in a democratic understanding, should not be viewed simply as the attribute of heroes or of outstanding or exceptional individuals. We are all creative, I think, as we go. And that's the kind of everyday creativity, which is still admirable and central to courage.
I'm referring to Aristotle in part because I know him and Plato the best, although you in your work refer to the full expanse of classical Athenian philosophers. But Aristotle ends up writing, when he writes in his Ethics, about the habituation of the virtues. And he implies that if you are truly a courageous person, that courage will never be difficult, that courage is just what you do, and you don't even necessarily have to reflect on it. It's who you are. And Plato does something similar, although not as explicitly, with his account of the harmony of the soul, which we don't have to get into. But you just talked about the everyday difficulties of life. And I know you have children as well, and so you know, as many of our listeners do, how difficult being a parent can be, even though it is such an ordinary thing. Do you think that courage in those contexts is the Aristotelian notion that courage is just an act of character, it's habituated, and it isn't difficult because it's what you want? Or does modern democratic courage have to have an element of effort, an element of difficulty? In the American ethos, we value things that people have to try harder for. We tend to value less the things that become easy. Do you think that courage has to be effortful and difficult, or is it just something that is who we are and we act that way without much will?
Well, I think that when Aristotle is talking the way you mentioned, when he is suggesting that our psychological makeup is such that all of our emotions and ideas and reasoning and so on are firing like pistons correctly in alignment, I think that He doesn't necessarily mean that it's easy for a person to stand up in the face of death. He means that he has a kind of harmonious, that is, aligned soul that enables him to do that very reliably, and even in a sense, if possible, to gain a measure, let's say, of self-respect from doing so. That might be a kind of pleasure that he takes in doing so. But I think that, yes, that courage requires effort, that it's very difficult to imagine somebody using the word without referring somehow to determination, or even, it's not only boldness, it's not only daring in the face of danger, but sometimes it is endurance. Sometimes it is the endurance of suffering, like a courageous cancer patient, for example, who has a kind of inner fortitude. And I think in that case, the effort that's involved is in maintaining one's sense of dignity, let's say, or the will to live. All of these things are effortful and deserve recognition. Now, I don't say that Aristotle himself elaborated the concept in that way, right. But I do think that what I'm saying is consistent at least with the general Platonic conception of courage. I think Aristotle was doing something a bit different, but it's consistent with what I'm saying, I think.
Is there still attachment at all to the Greek conception of the unity of the virtues? And what I mean by that is there are a lot of Greek philosophers who believe that you can't be courageous without being moderate. You can't be moderate without being beautiful. You can't be beautiful without being just. You can't be just without being temperate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yet we tend now to talk about courage in isolation. Do you think that the contemporary democratic traditions or the variety, the 18th century, the 19th century, that there's any attachment to this notion of the unity of the virtues, or do we think of courage as a discrete, atomistic character trait?
Well, I do think that the idea of the unity of the virtues has been very difficult to maintain in recent centuries, certainly since the American founding and onward, and that very few would hold to it today, on the one hand, certainly. I also think that when people think of courage as a completely independent or discrete virtue, they run the risk of dissociating courage from the framework of justice or freedom, etc., in which it makes sense. So I would say that personally, I believe that the notion of the unity of the virtues has a great deal of power in the following way, that if you think that, say, the highest virtue of an individual or a democracy is its practical wisdom, its ability to its sort of situational appreciation, its clarity about what is right or what is best and so forth, that the other virtues, such as courage or justice, fair-mindedness or generosity and so on, in a sense follow from that kind of controlling wisdom about our situation. And we're talking about ideals that we will never reach, but I think it's important to have these ideas in mind because we can at least realize what we may be aspiring to.
I think that's a great point, and I guess I have to ask, to what extent is courage an ideal, and to what extent is it realizable? I mean, we all know acts of courage. We've all seen them, heard of them. Many of us have engaged in them. But we are talking about ideals. So to what extent are we creating expectations that no one really expects us to see, and to what extent are we creating requirements, and that if we don't fulfill them, not only are we morally reprehensible, but we disappoint the people who care about us or who need us or who are watching us?
Well, I think that it's not as though we are creating these things and then imposing them on other people, like our listeners, for example, today. We all already believe in the importance of courage. And the question is to lay bare what is essential to courage, what its demands are, what it requires, so that we can avoid feeling a kind of shame in ourselves if we don't act well, if we don't act in a way that we can respect. And again, I think that it's important not to think of courage as an exceptional quality of heroes, but actually to be clear about it on the one hand, but also to recognize that it is an ordinary feature of life that ordinary people typically exhibit in living their lives well. So in that sense, it's not so aspirational as to be crushing of our attempts to cultivate the virtue.
Are you more courageous since you started studying courage? I mean, does the knowledge of what courage is and the examination of it, does the inquiry have an effect on your character? I mean, to a certain extent, right, there are people who think, incorrectly, I might add, that moral philosophers should be more moral than anyone else. And even if they should be more moral, we know for a fact that they
yes.
are not, right?
Yes, we do.
We expect we expect our knowledge, our inquiry, our research to have some impact on us. So are you more courageous because you've spent the last decade or so studying courage?
Well, that's a very good question. I've wondered about that too. And one, the humorist's answer would be that the audience is asked to wait 15 years for my autobiography. but in lieu of that, I would say that thinking about these things has made me understand myself better. And it's made me recognize that the more risks that I take, the more confident in the face of danger and thoughtful about these issues I can be. And in that sense, actually, I really have learned something about how to live my own life. One other thing, too. I've learned that when I think about fear, of course, there are good fears and bad fears, reasonable fears and unreasonable fears. And I think that I've learned that by looking at my own fears or other people's fears, by talking about them and thinking about them, I think we can reduce their hold on us. And that is often a good thing because fear tends not only to inhibit us from acting, but also to reduce the clarity of our thinking.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because, of course, what this suggests is that there's another continuity between contemporary democratic life and the Greek life, which is the virtue, although I don't think the Greeks would call it that, of self-awareness, right? The Delphic Oracle demanded that people know thyself. And we in the democratic, even in the me generation that is now, I guess, the last generation, there's a sense that you have to not only be true to yourself, but know who you are in order to know who to be true to. So is that a continual theme, that self-critical investigation is a kind of courage and it's a kind of moral expectation that if you don't know yourself, if you aren't self-aware, if you don't have a sense of who you really are and what you're striving for, that you are cowardly, at least in respect to how you deal with yourself?
Well, I think myself that self-knowledge is probably the greatest legacy that ancient Greek, as a concept, that ancient Greece has given us, that the importance of self-knowledge. And what I mean is that self-knowledge is... It's not a static thing. I don't think it's very easy to know yourself in a complete definitive way. We're always projects. We're always unfolding ourselves. And when we learn about ourselves, typically it can be extremely painful. Typically we are not the people that we thought we were. And coming to understand one's own, particularly one's own limitations, I think is a very great good because it does a thing that philosophy can help us do, which is if it can't help us to be better people, if it can't help us to be just, generous, kind, and courageous at all times, at least it can help us to avoid huge mistakes. At least it can help us to avoid, say, acting on the basis of fear or things that we don't admire about ourselves. We can get clear about ourselves. And I think that is a strategy, a very helpful path, let's say, toward leading a more flourishing life.
I have to admit that I never really thought about it in such stark terms, but I'm inclined to agree with you that this is the great legacy of the classical Greek world, this notion of self-knowledge. And so I guess the last question, which you may not have an answer for, is there anything else? Is there anything else that we need to know about courage that you haven't mentioned, that I haven't brought up? Is there a particular aspect of courage that no one ever asks about that you wish people would you know, if I don't understand why they're not asking this question. Is there some aspect of the inquiry that we've missed that you think is key to really conceptualizing what courage is either then or now?
Well, I think that one thing that has been left out of account in many people's concept of courage or writing about courage is the role of the emotions and what role, for example, not only fear will play, but also shame, let's say, or anger, or other kinds of emotions, and what role these emotions play in our lives more generally. And I suppose that my take on this question is to say that the emotions are kind of powerful children within us that are shot through with ideas and beliefs, and they point us toward something important. They can be educated. Your emotions can change and should change the more you look at yourself, but they're not to be avoided, let's say. They're not simply things to be overcome, but they're things that can be cultivated, feelings and so forth, that can be cultivated for the sake of acting courageously, but also serving the ends of justice or freedom or, democratic rights and so on.
Well, and this is a very 18th century notion. It's not the Kantian legacy, but it's the other one. It's the Hume, it's the Smith, it's the Scots. And the Greeks saw emotions as things that needed to be contained by the intellect and the will, or harmonized at least and controlled by the will. The Scots really thought that you could develop emotions in this particular way. So would you then consider courage part of the phrase now that we use, emotional intelligence? Is courage part of emotional intelligence, or is it rational, a product of rationality, or is it a different category? Where in the sort of in the contemporary map of the human psyche do we find courage?
Well, that's a very good question. When people speak of emotions or emotional intelligence, I wouldn't want to separate that to such an extent from rationality. I think the Greeks were leaders, let's say, within the European tradition in understanding that emotions have reasons of their own, that there is a kind of unified self. And so I suppose what I would say is that the notion of the harmony of the soul or the cultivation of the emotions is something that, the Greeks as well as the Scots, but not Kantian, not the Kantians and Kant's legacy and so on, that they are very strong on. Honestly, now that we've been talking about the emotions, could you I've become so emotional that I need you to just quickly repeat your last question.
Sure. The question is basically, given how we think about the human mind these days,
is courage. Yeah. Well, I think we should look at it. However we anatomize the soul, let's say, or the psyche, however we divide it up for analytical purposes, the way that I would understand courage is as a kind of orientation, a kind of turning, in a sense, toward the light, let's say, seeing things in the correct light. It's an attribute of ourselves as an entirety. In fact, not even only of our psychology, of course, but our bodies. We have come to understand, as you know, that our bodies and our minds are so intimately intertwined in ways that we had never thought of before. But there is a kind of also a muscle memory that is related to courage and a correct orientation, I think. So I would say that it's more like a turning of the self toward what is right, toward clarity, and toward, leading a flourishing life.
And so despite the adrenaline response, despite the shaking, despite all of that, courage, if I hear you right, still contains or still at the kernel of what we would have to consider to be noble. Courage is a kind of nobility, or at least an important piece of it.
I think courage is a kind of nobility that is available to all people, even those who are not born noble. But yes, it is a kind of admirable, worthwhile, disposition that we can embrace. And I think that that's the thing that's most important for people to realize.
That is, I think, both a moving and a useful way to end the conversation, because all of our listeners now both have the injunction and also realize the option that they can be courageous if they want, regardless of where they come from or who they are. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Thank you, Jack. It's been great.
You've been listening to Ryan Ballett and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'll be back with a few thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. You know, whenever we have a conversation like this, I'm really faced with this difficult task of how do we talk about something so abstract? How do we talk about something that's so large? Courage is a virtue in classical Athens, but we don't have this notion of virtue in the same way. So how do we manage all of these different factors? The answer, I think, is to start with examples, but it's also to start with role models. And that's something that Ryan and I really didn't have a chance to talk much about. The Greeks loved role models. They loved a sense that here is a courageous person, act like him in their instance, although we would say her as well. Act as if they, as if you were they, and then eventually it will become a part of you. This is also that notion of development that's essential, that you build courage up yourself over time. Courage is a character virtue because it's something that you create for yourself and that you are largely responsible for, but it's social. It depends on your circumstances and it also influences other. We need to have a new conversation about courage. We need to have a conversation in the democratic context and in a global context because, as Ryan's example of Susan Sontag suggested, we really don't seem to know what we're talking about. We've just stuck in political categories. You're listening to Ryan Ballett and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua e Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/markweinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.